This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Retribution, an EMP survival story by John Winchester. Narrated by Travis Baldry. Prologue. 3 years after the EMP. A thick fog lay over the land, filling the valley below and clinging to the steep mountain slopes. The early morning air was crisp and carried with it earthy smells coming from the freshly turned soil in the fields that lay along either side of the road. A small caravan was parked in the road, made up of a hodgepodge of wagons drawn by teams of mules and horses. Each wagon was unique, maintaining resemblance to its old form and function. One wagon was made from the bed of an old pickup truck and had a canvas roof and tall side walls made out of plywood. Another wagon looked strikingly similar to an antique-covered wagon from the Old West. It was a landscaper's trailer that someone had modified by affixing fiberglass poles on either side of the trailer, bent over to create an upside-down U-shaped frame. Several layers of translucent plastic painter's sheets were stretched tightly across the frame, providing a watertight area for cargo. Men and women loaded crates, boxes, and bags of their personal gear into the wagons. The amount of gear varied depending on the size of the family driving the wagon. Most of the wagons belonged to families. Single men drove a few others. Personal items were tossed into the wagons with haste. However, they all showed great care when loading the bulk of the cargo. Large wooden crates labeled Wheeler Corn Whiskey were placed beside others marked Wheeler Moonshine and were transferred into the wagons from the open bay doors of a wooden building standing next to the road. Each crate was filled with glass and ceramic jugs and tightly packed with straw to keep the bottles from banging against each other on their journey. Four stern-looking men in black leather jackets and biker clothes rode their horses up and down the road. Rifles in hand, they kept a watchful eye on the caravan and the goods being loaded into the carts, scanning the road and surrounding area in a cool and professional manner. Their leather jackets had large patches sewn onto the backs, identifying them as members of the Joker's Hangman Motorcycle Club. Formerly an outlaw biker gang, they were now part of Wheeler's standing security force. Kenny Miller lifted one of the heavy wooden crates and set it on the tail of a wagon, earning him a smile from the young brunette woman who stood at the other end of the wagon, carefully stacking the crates. His pulse quickened as he returned her smile. Lost in the moment, Kenny leaned against the back of the wagon, awestruck by her beauty. A man behind him cleared his throat, causing Kenny to turn around. A crate of whiskey was shoved into his arms. "Are we loading the wagon or making doe eyes at each other?" the girl's father asked. The girl, Sarah, blushed, and then went back to stacking crates. A firm hand gripped his shoulder and shook him playfully. Mr. Young loved to give him a hard time, but it was all in good fun. He knew he was fortunate to have a girlfriend with such an easygoing father. Kenny genuinely liked the man. Mr. Young was hard-working, honest, and fair, and also a good husband and father. Kenny would have liked the man even if he wasn't Sarah's father, which was fortunate, because if everything went according to plan, the man would be his father-in-law next fall. "Make sure you spread the weight evenly when you stack those crates. There's going to be rough roads ahead. We don't want the wagon to tip, and we definitely don't want to lose any of that liquor," Mr. Young said.
Yeah, we all know, Dad."
Sarah's brother, Andrew, rolled his eyes and tossed a pair of sacks into the wagon.
"Think fast, Kenny,"
Andrew said, jabbing a playful punch in Kenny's ribs and then leaping back as Kenny returned the blow.
"Leave those kids be, James. They know what they're doing," a woman said.
Sarah's mother, Jessica, was always quick to defend her daughter from her father's micromanagement. She squinted her eyes at him in mock irritation. Kenny laughed at their banter. Kenny lifted another crate and set it onto the wagon. They did, in fact, know what they were doing. The whole town did. Wheeler ran its own distillery, after all, manned by the town's residents. Everyone moved with a practiced efficiency, demonstrating their familiarity with handling the delicate crates of liquor. Today was a very important day for the entire community, and many residents stood alongside the road, waiting to watch the caravan as it departed. This was the first time Wheeler would send a caravan out. They would make the long trip to sell their goods and then, with the return from the sales, buy salt and return home.
Wheeler had done quite well for itself in the past couple of years. The town's distillery produced corn whiskey and moonshine, which they originally sold to other communities via the train that came into town once a week. Eventually, the railroad company had taken notice of their success and began to charge outrageous sums of money to transport their goods. Shipping costs were now an unacceptable percentage of their costs, eating deeply into the profit margin. Wheeler residents did the math and quickly determined that they would be far better off finding their own way to transport the liquor. The town began to search for alternatives to the railroad. A small caravan was the simple solution. They already had wagons and the draft animals. Labor to drive the wagons and provide security also was available and cheap. It was the middle of May and planting season was over, so farmers weren't needed until later in the summer. Transporting the liquor now seemed like an overlooked bit of additional revenue that had been left on the table. The caravan's first stop would be Huntington, where they would sell the bulk of the whiskey and moonshine all at once. Huntington was a small city on the Ohio River that had become a major regional trading hub. From there, the liquor was shipped on riverboats to Cincinnati or Louisville or even further downstream. Once the idea took root, some enterprising citizen had the idea that the caravan should do more than ship liquor out. They could import materials and goods as well. Each year, the town purchased a large amount of salt, most of it from the railroad company. In a world without artificial preservatives and refrigeration, salt was a requirement for keeping food through the winter. Everybody knew that the railroad inflated the prices, doubling or tripling the cost of the vital necessity. If they could bypass the railroad and eliminate the shipping fees on their whiskey and the salt they purchased, they could more than double their profits. The caravan could kill two birds with one stone. After selling the liquor, the caravan would leave Huntington flush with cash, which was usually in the form of easily transportable hard currency, such as gold and silver. Their return route would bring them close to Malden, which had a large salt mining operation. There, they would purchase as much salt as the wagons would carry directly from the mine, eliminating the railroad company's cut as a middleman. That much salt would fulfill the town's needs for 2 or 3 years. It would also provide them peace of mind, knowing it was there when they needed it. Even after accounting for the salt purchase, there would be a tidy profit left over to pay the caravan workers and guards. The round trip would take around a month to complete. 13 or 14 days on the road from Wheeler to Huntington, followed by another 14 days of travel to stop at Malden, pick up the salt, and then return home. The caravan had enough provisions for 6 weeks of travel, and if worse came to worst, they could trade some of their cargo for provisions along the way. Kenny paused in his work, glancing over at Sarah as she stacked her belongings for the trip. His stomach knotted up. 3 weeks without seeing Sarah. It was bad enough that he had to wait for Sundays after all of his work on the homestead was finished to go and see her. Now she was packing up to leave on a long and dangerous trip. He wanted to pull her aside and ask her to stay home from the trip, but he resisted the urge. It was selfish and short-sighted, but he couldn't stop himself from wishing she would stay at home and let someone else go in her place. What if something went wrong? The thought of her being so far away from him made him feel helpless. Almost like when his father was out of town for business during the EMP. There had been nothing he could do but worry.
"Kenny, are you all right?"
Sarah asked, her brow creased.
"You don't look well."
Kenny shook his head, put on a brave face, and then lifted another crate into the wagon.
"I'm fine. You don't have to worry about me. It's you I'm worried about. How are you going to make it 3 weeks without seeing me?"
"Shut up, Kenny. You're so full of yourself,"
Sarah said, laughing. As hard as it was going to be watching her go, he knew that it had to be done if they were going to be married next year. They both scrimped and saved every penny they had. She could earn far more money working on the caravan alongside her mother and father than she could if she stayed at home. Kenny was clearing a new field to plant grains he could sell to the distillery and also worked odd jobs for money. Their plan was to marry next fall after the harvest was in and he sold the grains. Both of them wanted to start their lives off on the right foot, and were doing everything they could to buy land of their own. Kenny had a nice spread picked out, right next to Wyatt's homestead. His family's homestead, he corrected himself, although he didn't think he could ever come to think of it as the Miller homestead. It would always remain Wyatt's homestead in his mind. The tract he wanted to buy consisted of 40 acres of fields and 30 acres of woods,
all being sold for below market price by their neighbor. The neighbor was an old friend of Wyatt's and needed to raise money, but said he also wanted to make sure the land was sold to people he could get along with. Good neighboring had paid off. Each fall since he'd been here, he had helped the old-timer split firewood, till his fields, and do other odd jobs, and so the land offer was made to him first. 40 acres wasn't a huge amount of land, but it was enough. More than he could plow with a good team of horses, anyway. 30 acres of woodland would supply them with enough timber to build a small cabin and provide them with enough firewood. It wouldn't be anything fancy, but it would be their place to call home. So it wasn't easy to let her go, but it would be well worth the sacrifice of a few weeks together so that they could have a leg up on the rest of their time as man and wife. His dad had taught him the importance of making a sacrifice for what mattered in life. He had made it home from halfway across the country, venturing into the unknown, and sacrificed his health to be at home again with his family. With nothing more than his will to get through rough times, he and Wyatt gave up everything they knew and tossed the dice, leaving their future to the fates during the journey home. Kenny wanted to go with the caravan. He had planned to, but those plans had been canceled. His father had left town the week before. Jack was one of several volunteers from Wheeler to go and help a small mountain community 30 miles away that was in a desperate battle against a forest fire that threatened their homes and fields. His dad was sorely missed on the homestead. Kenny needed his help. He, Danny, and his mother were hard-pressed to keep up with everything that needed to be done around the homestead. His father did his duty, though. He placed a great amount of importance on helping others and being part of the larger community beyond the borders of their small town. Kenny knew it was easy enough to talk about sacrifice. It was much harder to actually make sacrifices. It was a dangerous world beyond the borders of Wheeler. Diseases, criminals, and even simple misunderstandings could spell disaster and end a person's life in an instant. Recently, there were rumors that people had gone missing, never to be heard from again. And those were just the readily acknowledged dangers. There was still the slim chance of 100 other dangers and disasters that he'd never even considered. Having lived through the EMP, such an unlikely event, it wasn't so easy for him to casually dismiss them. Deep inside, he was worried that he might never see Sarah again. He had a sense of foreboding, a sinking feeling about the trip. But he wouldn't let her see that he was afraid and give her cause for concern. She had enough to worry about in the coming weeks. Besides, her brother Andrew, her father, and 4 of the Joker's hangmen and enforcers were going along with them. And then there were all of the other men and women going along on the caravan, all of them armed. He was most likely worried about nothing. Wasn't he? 1 month later. Chapter 1. Chief Bud Howell sat down in a wooden swing chair hanging from the branch of an old maple tree in his backyard. He leaned back and closed his eyes, letting his momentum and the stiff wind blowing through the valley rock the chair. The wind shook the leaves in the tree canopy above him and provided a small amount of relief from the sweltering heat of the July midday sun. He brought a paper up to his face, rereading the first few lines of the handwritten report several times over before he folded it up and shoved it into his shirt pocket. The report was important. It detailed the planting schedules of local farms and family gardens, giving him an insight into the community's food output for the year. That box of seeds Jack had brought with him from Baltimore had meant a world of difference in the types and amounts of vegetables and grains they were able to grow, ensuring they had a good yield as they experimented with different varieties. Howell knew it was critically important, but he just couldn't seem to concentrate on it this morning. His mind was preoccupied with other things. He was getting old and was starting to feel it in his bones. He felt like he was losing his edge. This morning he'd woken up at dawn, roused by the crowing of a rooster, only to lie back down and sleep the better part of the morning away. It seemed to be happening more frequently these days. This malaise was only getting worse. It was time to hang up his hat as Wheeler's chief of police and let somebody younger do the job. He had just the person in mind for the job, too. Somebody who was a perfect fit for the position, even if the man didn't see himself that way yet. At the next town hall gathering, when everyone was there to hear, he would announce his resignation, followed by his stump speech for the next chief of police.
The announcement would come as a surprise to everyone, including the candidate, who he knew might need a little shove from the community to accept the position. There was nothing like putting somebody on the spot in front of a large group of people to force his hand. That would have to wait, though, until Jack Miller was back. Right now, he was volunteering as a firefighter, helping to put out a massive forest fire half a state away. It was just the kind of sacrifice Jack made without asking for anything in return. He was a good man. Weeks ago, the town of East Fork had sent word in every direction, requesting help with a forest fire that threatened their community. Jack had been the first to volunteer. Jack was still there, although he wasn't sure if Jack was still fighting the fire at this point or had stayed on to help rebuild. Chief Howell couldn't think of a more fair and honest person to take the position. He needed someone who everybody in Wheeler knew, liked, and respected. He also needed someone that had worked with other nearby communities. After Jack's issues with Shane, not everyone in Long Branch liked him, but they damn sure respected him. Lost in his thoughts, Chief Howell didn't hear the man walking up behind him.
"Chief Howell, sleeping on the job, I see,"
the stranger said. Chief Howell jumped up, startled out of his daydream. He turned around, relieved to see that he knew the speaker. Cursing himself, he realized he really was losing his edge if a man could walk down the gravel driveway without alerting him.
"Sheriff Sutherland," Chief Howell said, surprised to see his old friend. "How the hell have you been?" "Oh, fine. Just fine. It's good to see you. Let's dispense with the titles, bud. Hell, it hasn't been that long, has it? What's it been? 3 years now?"
the sheriff asked. 3 years. It was hard to believe that so much time had passed. The past 3 years had seemed like an eternity. Post-EMP life went by fast. It felt like he'd aged 10 years in the past three.
"Can I get you something to drink, Jerry? Wheeler makes a pretty mean corn whiskey. I got moonshine, too, if that suits you better." "Thanks, but no thanks. I don't drink much these days. Need to keep my wits about me,"
Sheriff Sutherland said.
"I hear you. I quit myself some time ago."
Chief Howell noticed something different about his old friend. The normally stoic man looked anxious, as if something was eating at him.
"Well, what can I do for you? What brings you to these parts?" "I need to call in a favor. Something fishy is going down. It needs to be investigated, but I can't do it myself,"
Jerry said, his forehead wrinkled in thought.
"It's a long story." "I got nowhere to be, Jerry. Shoot." "This all started about a year ago, or at least that is when I began to recognize the problem. I noticed that other states were pulling far ahead of West Virginia in terms of recovery. While we've done a decent job of reestablishing law and order, other things have lagged behind badly. Take trade, for example. In other states, cottage industries have sprung up to replace all of the goods we used to import from China. I was in Ohio a month ago and saw for myself the difference in how people are living. In one small town I stopped in, just like Wheeler, I saw an open-air market set up by the railroad station. A train had stopped there, and people unloaded goods manufactured in other small towns. You wouldn't believe the variety of things you could buy from the traders on that train. Compare that to what you have here. No offense, but when the train comes into town, you can hardly find more than the bare necessities, and even those are priced beyond the reach of many people. At first, I thought things would balance out. It would just take time. But things haven't gotten better. There's something more going on here. It's almost as if we're being held back by design. I have a guess who's doing it, but I can't prove it. Call it a hunch," Jerry said.
Chief Howell sat up straight, intrigued by what he was driving at. As a fellow officer, when Jerry said he had a hunch about something, he took that seriously. After many years on the job, you developed a nose for such things and could smell a rat from a mile away. You learned to trust your instincts and follow the clues where they led. Ignoring your gut instincts was a surefire way to end up dead.
"Who do you think is responsible?" "Victor Tweed. I'm sure you've heard of him. His name is on everybody's lips these days." "Tweed. What makes you think he's holding things back? Seems like an awful lot for a single man to be responsible for,"
Chief Howell said. Jerry nodded and took off his broad-brimmed sheriff's hat, wiping the sweat from his brow before he replaced it on his head.
"He's a bit more than just an ordinary man, though. Listen, this guy came out of nowhere. 3 years ago, nobody had heard of him, and now he's one of the richest men in the state. I'll be blunt here. Tweed has taken advantage of the power vacuum created by the EMP. Everyone has been so focused on getting things back to the way they used to be, nobody seems to be worried about how we get there. There are no regulations and little government oversight at the state or federal level. Just take a look at how he does business. He owns the Appalachian Express Railroad Company, the only railroad company left in the state. Tweed bought up every single running antique steam locomotive in West Virginia, southern Ohio, and clear up to Pittsburgh, offering sums of money that made the owners think he was nuts. I can guarantee you that they are second-guessing themselves now that Tweed's got a monopoly. He's jacked up shipping rates to 10 times what they used to be. And that's not all. He owns the Anchor Riverboat Company. It's the same story with the railroad companies he bought up. Tweed got his start in the riverboat business a couple of years ago. He was a ship's mate. Small potatoes until the captain he worked for had a freak accident. Tweed got a loan and purchased the ship, and then grew his business from there. Now he owns nearly all of the shipping companies within 200 miles of here. He'll gobble the rest up soon, mark my words. Keep in mind, it's not the monopolies that really bother me. It is how he goes about it that strikes me as wrong. Ask yourself, why would these riverboat captains and railroad engineers that own successful companies, living the American dream, give up their companies so easily? They were making good money. I'll tell you why, although many of them are too ashamed to admit the truth and will deny it. He uses his power and money to intimidate people. Some of the companies that didn't want to sell found themselves forced out of the market. One old-timer I spoke to claimed he'd been beaten by some of Tweed's thugs, but of course, it's nearly impossible to prove anything like that. Tweed is too smart to get caught doing something like that directly. Dark alley, no witnesses, you know how it goes. Tweed has damn near everybody in his pocket. Bankers, police, politicians. It's gotten so bad that Tweed's politicians are openly criticizing recovery efforts originating from outside of the state. They refuse financial assistance and aid, saying they don't want or need outside help and interference. Tweed doesn't want things to change. He's making a fortune with things just the way they are now.
Chief Howell rubbed his chin absently.
That is disturbing news. He's got to be stopped, and it has to be now. Tweed is running for governor. We have to act now before he's elected. Once he establishes himself as a legitimate politician, he can sweep all of this dirty business under the rug. Tweed is dirty. I know he's hiding something. I just can't put my finger on what it is. He's been quietly replacing people in positions of power throughout the state, supplanting them with people he has influence over. You remember Warden Dodson at the Olive State Penitentiary? He was killed last month in suspicious circumstances. I wouldn't have been surprised to hear he'd been replaced, but his death came as a shock. Why kill him? Why not just replace him? What did he know? Warden Dodson was replaced by Butch Metz.
Metz? That fool? He was lining his pockets even before the EMP, Howell said.
You and I both know it.
But Dodson was no saint either. Why replace one corrupt official with another? Chief Howell asked.
That's a mighty good question. One that I'd like to ask, which brings us to the heart of the issue. I've been too loud about my opposition to Tweed. I can't investigate the issue any further. I seem to hit roadblock after roadblock. Not only that, but I've been followed by Tweed's men. I caught one of them and scared him off, but I suspect there are others.
Sheriff Sutherland took his hat off, fiddling with it in his hands.
I need someone unknown to Tweed, someone else to pick up on the investigation. You're the only one I can trust with this, Sheriff Sutherland said.
Howell sat back in his seat and sighed.
I can't say I disagree with your assessment. We felt the pinch from the railroad fee hikes here, too. Salt, coal, damn near everything is 10 times what it cost when the Sangerstrom Rail Company ran things. I'll look into it, Howell said.
I appreciate it, bud. I'm sorry to put this on you, but I don't have anybody else to turn to. I can't stress enough how urgent this is. I'm heading up to Huntington to look into an unrelated issue, and then I'm heading home. Let me know what you find out,
Sheriff Sutherland said.
I'll leave tomorrow morning. As soon as I find anything out, I'll let you know, Howell said.
If Jerry's suspicions were accurate, then there was a reason that the recovery effort was taking so long. Someone was to blame. Warden Dodson was as crooked as an old nail, but the thought that he had been murdered still left his blood running cold. Killing a warden of a state penitentiary?
That was bold indeed. As much as he wanted to set his badge and guns down, Howell knew Jerry wouldn't ask for his help unless he was truly desperate. If Victor Tweed was behind all of this, then he would have to be careful with the investigation and do some quiet digging. A man who had no compunction about hiring killers was not someone to trifle with. Chief Howell waved goodbye as Jerry mounted his horse and rode off, then went inside the house to gather up the supplies he would need for the trip. He wrote a note to Dutch, letting him know he would be away for a while, sealed it in an envelope, and addressed it to Dutch's attention. On the way out of town tomorrow, he'd stick the envelope in the door jamb of the motorcycle club. He'd ride out early tomorrow morning, when it was cooler, and get to the bottom of this business with Tweed. Chapter 2 A bolt of lightning reached down from the dark gray storm clouds on the horizon and touched the earth. A few seconds later, the rolling boom of thunder arrived. 2 days of storms had left the Ohio River a chocolate brown color. Tree branches and other debris floated in the muddy water, washed into the river by the storm. The bits of flotsam and jetsam bumped against the bow of a steam-powered riverboat before continuing on downstream. The riverboat, named the Dawn Till Dusk, faced upstream. The ship's paddle wheel churned the dirty water behind the ship, keeping a steady position in relation to the shore as the crew pulled a fishing net taut, tying it off onto the side of the ship. A line of floats stretched between the riverboat and a utility pole sticking up out of the water 60 yards away. 10 feet of the utility pole stood above the waterline, painted bright orange to give other ships warning of the navigational hazard. The rest of the pole was sunk deep into the riverbed, providing a stout anchoring point for the submerged gill net stretched between the riverboat and the pole. A fin surfaced above the water, vigorously splashing as a fish struggled in a vain attempt to free itself from the net. Soon the net's floats danced about, tugged by several more trapped fish. Watching the fish splash in the net, Captain Patty O'Donnell sighed with relief at the indication of a good haul. She opened the small windows in the ship's wheelhouse to allow the breeze to blow through the confined space. The heavy thunderstorms had prevented her from fishing, and they had a quota to fill. Captain O'Donnell grabbed a rag from her pocket and wiped the sweat from her brow. It was one of the hottest days she could ever remember, and it was only the middle of July. Thankfully, the storm created a stiff wind, providing some relief from the stifling humidity and heat as she looked out of the wheelhouse windows. On the main deck below, the crew had finished setting the nets, and several of the men hauled buckets of water up from the river, dousing their bodies with the water to cool off. One of the younger crewmen upturned a bucket of river water over an unsuspecting crewman's head, inciting him to chase the prankster around the ship. The younger man was caught, and more roughhousing ensued. Captain O'Donnell shook her head and laughed, but didn't interfere. Once the nets were set and the crew had completed their other tasks, she let them do as they wished. Each and every one of the crew was on top of their game where there was work to be done, and gave it their all. Fishing was physically demanding work, hauling nets in and gutting the fish at a frantic pace so that the nets could be set again as quickly as possible. It wasn't a 9-to-5 job like the old days. The crew worked long hours, fishing until the boat's holds were full or until the sun set, whichever came first. Not that she'd ever had a 9-to-5 job. Before the EMP, she was a towboat captain, pushing barges up and down the Ohio River. At times, it felt like she'd lived most of her life on a towboat pushing barges up and down the river. 16 years piloting a boat up and down the same river was a long time any way you cut it. An old and familiar hollowness filled her as the twist of fate that made her captain of a towboat was brought to mind. Her husband, Big Pete, had died long ago, leaving her a single parent to 3 boys. Their youngest son, Garrett, was only 8 years old at the time. Big Pete, the first Captain O'Donnell of the family, was an owner-operator of a towboat. His job had been their only source of income. Patty had worked on riverboats, too, as a deckhand and cook in her early 20s, but she stopped working after they were married to raise the children. Once Big Pete was gone, she took the reins and put herself into the captain's chair. Her 3 boys came with her on the job, the oldest of them pitching in to help, and the 2 younger boys playing on the floor of the wheelhouse while she worked. Her sons, Pete, Tommy, and Garrett, were grown men now and faithful crew.
Nearly all of the crew was family. Her brother, Don, and four nephews filled out the rest. It still seemed strange to her that the family made their living on a boat right out of a history book. It wasn't nostalgia that brought the boat into being. The boat was a design born of necessity. After the EMP, she and her family focused on survival just like everyone else. They had kept themselves fed by using homemade gill nets to catch the plentiful Asian bighead carp and silver carp. The two species of fish came up the lower Ohio River after conquering the entire Mississippi River. Originally considered an invasive species, they weren't considered a nuisance any longer. The fish were plentiful and easy to catch, reproducing almost as fast as they could be caught. The surplus of fish led to bartering with neighboring towns for other goods. As she began to export the surplus catch, a fishing industry was born, one that fed thousands of people in surrounding areas. At some point, she realized there was an opportunity for enterprising individuals to do more than sell fish, and she could make a living shipping goods using the steam-powered riverboat. Steam power was the only power these days. 3 years after the EMP, gas and diesel were still a rarity, nearly as rare of a sight as a working electrical device. She'd heard the rumors that there was a refinery operating in Texas, but it was a strategic resource, only used to provide fuel for the U.S. military. Modern ships with electric ignitions and diesel engines weren't going to make a comeback anytime soon, and that was what led her to build the first steam-powered paddle boat. The ship was versatile, fueled by either coal or wood, and her shallow draft allowed her to navigate where vessels with a deeper hull couldn't go. Her upper deck was equipped with davits, or small cranes, and allowed cargo to be hoisted on board. The first deck was designed to allow her to perform both operations of fishing and hauling large quantities of freight. Word about the riverboat soon got out, and Patty found herself with more shipping contracts than she knew what to do with. A year after the EMP, they had food and a boat, but they didn't have a large-scale source of salt to cure the fish. That need was eventually filled by a salt mine in Malden, West Virginia, just off the Ohio River. The mine shipped salt down to the port city of Huntington, West Virginia, where she picked it up and carried it down the Ohio River to the family-run fishery. For a solid year, her riverboat had free rein of the river, the only boat shipping goods and salted carp up the Ohio River. Within months, imitators sprouted up and a fleet of steam-powered boats trolled for carp and other native fish. Prices dropped, and Captain O'Donnell was forced to travel further upstream to sell where the fish were more valuable. Shipping competition had grown fierce as well. An aggressive company out of Cincinnati, Anchor Riverboat Company, owned by a scumbag named Victor Tweed, had bought up ships left and right. Smaller riverboat captains were bought up or forced out of the market by Tweed's fleet of ships. His larger fleet undercut prices and made it unprofitable to operate at a smaller scale. Recently, things had become even more cutthroat. The few holdout riverboat captains like her had begun to leave town without notice. Just a week before, she spoke with a captain who had been beaten to within an inch of his life after he dared outbid a Tweed shipping contract. The authorities had done nothing about it, a sad sign of the times. The world was a more dangerous place now. People died or went missing much more frequently than before the EMP. Her own young niece had gone missing a few months ago. She had walked into town one evening and never came home. Her niece was a troubled young woman, but it had seemed strange that she would up and leave her family without a single word of goodbye. She looked down at the main deck below, pride filling her as she watched the crew work. What started as fishing for survival had become a booming business. Even her brother Jamie, who could barely put his shoes on the correct feet, was involved. He ran the fishery where workers salted and cured the fish and supervised the warehouses where shipping goods were stored. Her reminiscing was interrupted as another steamboat appeared from around a bend in the river. The boat changed course from her position in the middle of the river and turned directly toward the dawn till dusk. Smoke bellowed from the ship's smokestack as it cut across the river, approaching rapidly. Captain O'Donnell reached up and rang the bell hanging from the wheelhouse, alerting her crew.
"Look alive! Pull that net in!" she yelled.
Turning the wheel, she tried to maneuver her unwieldy ship towards the utility pole to retrieve the net. It was too late, though. Dawn till dusk was moving against the current, and the other riverboat moved with the current, traveling downstream much faster than she could compensate for. The other riverboat passed directly over the gill net, and her crew tossed out ropes with hooks, which dragged the net and stretched it until it broke. The other riverboat's crew hurled insults and jeered at her as they came broadside. Captain O'Donnell raised her middle finger high into the air and cursed at the other ship, unsurprised to see the company name and logo printed on the side of the ship. Anchor Riverboat Company, one of Victor Tweed's ships. It was the third time this week this had happened. Tweed was attempting to intimidate her and push her out of the area. He would find out that she didn't intimidate so easily.
"Salvage what you can, then make ready to steam home," she said to the crew.
"Mom!" Her youngest son, Garrett, charged up the steps to the wheelhouse, his face bright red with anger. "Aren't we going to do anything?" She leveled her cool gray eyes on her son and frowned with disapproval to let him know what she thought of his outburst.
"And what will we do? They're long gone now. We could burn all our coal and give chase, but to what purpose? There are a dozen other Tweed boats within 100 miles of here, all with the same intent as that one. Tweed wants us to react to his provocations."
Garrett, her hot-headed child, took a deep breath, calming himself. Patty grabbed him by the shoulder, happy to see him control his emotions.
"Outthink your adversary, son. Otherwise, you're playing on their terms. You can't outthink someone when you're seeing red."
Garrett nodded and went back to work. The loss of a net was not worth confronting the other ship over, but it highlighted the larger problem that was brewing. Tweed had grown too big and treated the river as his own playground. Rules were out the window. It was a statement. He would do as he damned well pleased. It had to stop before people got hurt. She knew she would have to deal with it soon.
"Tell the crew we're going to drop off the catch at the fishery, then load up the freight. We're going to Huntington early. We've got business to attend to."
Chapter 3 Kenny looped a section of thick steel chain around the sawed-off stump of an enormous oak, cinching it tight. He'd felled all of the trees in the field last summer and allowed the root systems to partially decompose, which made removing the stumps much easier. After anchoring a block-and-tackle winch onto the chain around the huge tree stump, he hooked the tow chain onto a much smaller tree trunk. The block-and-tackle system gave him a mechanical advantage, multiplying the force applied to the chain several times over. Wiping the sweat from his brow, Kenny hooked the block-and-tackle's rope to a chain, which led to a pair of mules 20 yards away. Danny, also covered in sweat, held the mule team's lead and waited for him to give the go-ahead and urge the mules forward.
"Go ahead, Danny. We're hooked up."
Kenny stepped back and found a safe place to stand behind the sturdy trunk of an elm tree. The rope and chains comprising the winch system would be under a lot of pressure once the mules began to pull. Kenny had learned long ago to respect the power the block and tackle generated. If a rope or chain broke, it could easily send the chain, or even worse, the heavy block and tackle, flying in his direction, leaving him with a broken bone. Danny nodded his head in acknowledgement and led the mule team forward. The slack went out of the line as the block and tackle system became taut. The chains looped around the two tree stumps were drawn slowly together as the mules pulled. The sound of metal chains grinding against each other became louder as the chains tightened, and the smaller tree stump leaned heavily to the side. There were several loud, snapping sounds as the last of the tree roots broke off underneath the soil. With a final resounding crack, the tree stump gave way and was pulled out of the ground, leaving a sizable hole in the earth where the root ball had just been. Kenny stepped out from behind the safety of the elm tree and took up his shovel, knocking loose the dirt still clinging to the trunk's underside. The dirt fell away, and he shoveled it back into the hole, leveling it out with the surrounding ground as much as he could. The rich black soil was worth its weight in gold, and he didn't want to lose an ounce of it. It would provide ideal nutrients for the crops he planned to sow. Danny came around with the mule team, patting the neck of one of the muscular beasts, praising it for a job well done. He praised the second mule, and then untied the rope connecting them to the block and tackle.
"That's the last of them. Thanks for your help, Danny. It would have taken me all day to pull these stumps by myself. I appreciate you taking time from your other work to help me out. You'd better get back to the house and grab some lunch. It's getting hotter than hell out here,"
Kenny said.
"Anytime, Kenny. That's what brothers are for,"
Danny said. Kenny waited for the punchline to his brother's joke, but when Danny said nothing and handed him the mule's lead, he turned to walk the thirsty animals down by the stream. Just as he turned his back, a clod of dirt hit him in the back. Kenny turned and shouted after Danny as he retreated quickly up the hill.
"What's the matter with you?"
Halfway up the hill and safely out of his reach, Danny laughed and gave him an unfriendly salute. Kenny shook his head, suffering the insult in silence. It was hard to remember that Danny was 14 and not a grown man. He did more than his fair share of work, so Kenny let the occasional prank slide. Danny ran up the steep slope and then disappeared from view as he ran down the other side. As a muscular 14-year-old, he was unrecognizable as the same sickly boy that had nearly died 3 winters ago. With the help of the food their father had secured from the train, Danny had survived the illness and sprang back to health the following year. Since then, he hadn't stopped growing, much to Kenny's irritation. He was tall for a 14-year-old, only 2 inches short of Kenny's 6-foot height. He wasn't going to be the big brother for much longer, but Kenny was happy to relinquish the title. Danny had been through a lot and come out the other end a stronger person. From his vantage point under the shade of the tree, Kenny did a mental checklist of the remaining work for the day. All but the largest of the stumps were out of the ground, and what was left looked like a minefield with large holes where the stumps used to be. The field needed to be plowed, and he had to remove all the stones that lay under the soil. Still, most of the hard work was done. A few more weeks, and he would have the field in shape for planting next spring. Between Kenny, Danny, and their father, the three of them had made short work of felling the timber with a sharp 2-man crosscut saw. The mule team hauled the logs to rest near the house, where the wood cured and waited to be split into firewood. After the trees were downed, Kenny and Danny put the family's new goats to work. All you had to do was tether them to a stake with a long steel wire, and they would eat nearly everything in sight, removing brush, unwanted ground cover, and even sapling trees. They were highly effective at clearing the land, but occasionally the goats would get loose and wander off on their own, requiring somebody to locate them and bring them home. The goats had left a short, cropped field behind, ready to plow, aside from the largest stumps. The ones that remained were too large for the mule team to pull out, even with the help of the block-and-tackle system. Following the advice of an old-timer that lived next door, Kenny would simply plant around the stumps, leaving them in place where they would rot naturally over 10 or more years. Besides, the larger stumps provided a good anchoring point for the block-and-tackle system, removing stress from the mule team. He tried to make the job as easy and safe as possible. Kenny worried about injuring the animals, a family member, or himself. There was no ambulance to pick him up and cart him to the emergency room. There was no emergency room for that matter, nor were there supplies, nurses, or doctors. Wheeler used to have a doctor, but he passed away the year before. The closest medical attention was several miles away in Long Branch. With no cell phones or way to get help quickly, a bad injury out here in the field was serious business. Kenny stood up and led the mule team over to the far end of the clearing, where a weather-beaten old walking plow sat waiting to be hitched to the mule team. The plow's original red paint had almost entirely worn off, the long wooden handles worn smooth by years of weather and work. He attached the mule hitch to the plow and then replaced the short walking lead Danny had used to pull stumps with a much longer lead that stretched all the way back to the plow. Tossing the lead over his shoulder, he wiped the sweat from his brow and then grabbed hold of the plow's handles. Kenny made a loud clicking noise with his mouth, and the mule surged forward. The plow's sharp edge bit down into the earth and turned the soil over, leaving a rich black ribbon of earth in its wake. In addition to the soil, tree roots, rocks, and larger field stones were visible in the upturned dirt. It was sweaty and hard work, but Kenny couldn't imagine anything else he'd rather be doing. Things had definitely improved since that first hard winter on the homestead. Dad had fixed the windmill powering the well, and it pumped cold, clear water from deep underground. The pair of mules made tasks like pulling stumps and plowing fields much easier than it used to be. Their horse, Britches, could pull a wagon, but the little horse couldn't hope to keep up with the sturdy mules. They weren't cheap, but they were invaluable. In fact, without the neighbor's help, they couldn't have afforded to buy them. All types of livestock were far more valuable than they had been before the EMP, and it took the combined buying power of several neighbors to purchase the mules. His parents didn't have to put up any money for the team. They didn't have any. They worked out a deal with their elderly neighbors. Kenny, Jack, and Danny would provide the labor required for cutting down trees, pulling stumps, and plowing the soil for planting all of their farms, and the neighbors would purchase the mules. It was a good arrangement for everyone involved. Wheeling and dealing and the barter system paid for nearly everything these days. It seemed strange to him that before things changed, he used to ask his mom for a ride to the mall, borrow her credit card, and buy whatever he wanted. It didn't work like that anymore. Gold and silver were among the few items that held their value after the EMP. It was the most common way to make a large purchase for livestock or land. Before Wyatt passed away, he'd hammered home the lesson about hard currency. If modern civilization ever took off again and paper currency became the norm, Kenny would take his advice and keep a healthy amount of his wealth in gold or silver. Anybody would accept it. Gold and silver held universal value, even in a barter economy. It didn't rot like paper money did, and you could bury it in the ground and hide it from looters. He didn't think he could ever put his faith in a stack of paper bills or a piece of plastic again. The plow scraped a large rock under the soil, making a grating noise like nails on a chalkboard. A few feet further along, the plow jerked to a sudden halt, and the mule team took it as their cue to stop pulling and take a break. Kenny set the lead on the plow's handles, knowing from experience that the plow wasn't going to go anywhere without intervention. He picked up a long pry bar resting on a log next to a shovel and a pickaxe, then returned to the stuck mule team. Kenny jabbed the steel bar down into the soil until he found the edge of the rock, then leveraged his body weight until the heavy rock surfaced. Another stone. It was exactly what he expected, but every time he hit a rock, it piqued his interest, and he hoped for something to surface that never did. With the stone out of the way, he took the lead and clicked his tongue against his cheek, and the mule team moved forward, again cutting a neat line in the soil. Kenny gave a giggle at his excitement at hitting the fieldstone. It had been a devilishly cruel joke, an idea planted in his mind by Wyatt. During that long fall and winter, before he passed away, Wyatt used to tease them that there was treasure buried somewhere around the homestead. Now that Kenny was older, he realized that Wyatt was just trying to keep their mind off of their growling stomachs. But once the idea had been planted, it stuck. On days like today, when the plow seemed to catch on every large rock in the ground, his mind still jumped to the conclusion that he had just struck a metal safe full of gold coins buried under the ground. Wyatt had said that the real gold would be in this pasture, nestled in the valley. An adult now, Kenny took Wyatt's real meaning. The soil of the bottomland was dark and rich compared to the surrounding hills, full of nutrients. Once he turned the earth, the site would be ideal for growing barley and corn, and the large creek running the length of the narrow valley would ensure his plants would be well watered. With any luck, the new planting would double the family's grain production, which he would give to the town distillery. His contribution would be distilled and sold as liquor, and the proceeds would allow him to buy the spread of land for Sarah and him to call home. A shadow of concern crept over his heart at the thought of Sarah. He was starting to worry. A month had passed, and she was still somewhere out there on the road with the caravan. Hopefully they would be home soon. She might as well be on the far side of the moon. He missed her dearly. It sometimes felt like they were connected by an invisible link that no one else could see. He knew her thoughts and feelings without speaking a word, and she knew his. She must be going through the same agonizing heartache. They hadn't seen each other for weeks. Lost in his feelings about Sarah, Kenny pulled his arm back as a sudden and sharp pain came from his forearm. Kenny looked down and swatted at the yellow and black striped insect clinging to his forearm, insistent on stinging his arm yet again. He slapped at the wasp and drove it away, only to see dozens more swarming around him and the mules. The mules' ears flattened, and they stomped their hooves nervously, chomping at their bits. Kenny swatted at the wasps swarming around his face and tried to turn the mule team to lead them to safety, but there was an even larger cloud of wasps in the air behind him, streaming out of a hole in the ground that he'd just plowed over. Before he could react, the mules spooked and took off across the field, driven by the painful stings, the plow still turning the soil behind them as they ran. Kenny ran to catch up to them, ignoring the stings to his face, hands, and neck, worried that the animals would injure themselves in their reckless flight. He grasped at the lead as he ran after them, but couldn't take hold of it and still defend his face from the stinging wasps. The plow struck a large rock underneath the soil and came to an immediate stop. The mules struggled and strained in their efforts to flee from the wasps, stomping at the ground, their cries ear-splitting. A scraping and squealing noise sent a shiver down Kenny's back. He caught up to the mules just in time to hear a loud crack as something broke off underneath the soil. The other half of the plow surfaced, no longer hung up on the boulder beneath the soil. Kenny watched in horror as the mule team fled, dragging the useless piece of plow behind them. Still racing after the mule team, his heart sank as he watched them pull away. The plow's blade was split cleanly in half, torn asunder between the forces of the mules and the immovable rock. Kenny swatted at the remaining wasps that had diligently chased him across the field. Sweat poured off of him, soaking his clothes as he tried to find the mules. If they went too far and he couldn't find them, the mules were irreplaceable. Returning home without them was not an option. After an hour of searching, he found them in a patch of woods far from the field. The plow had hung up on an old run of barbed wire fence that cut across the property. The wasps were long gone, having successfully defended their nest from the intruders. His face, neck, and arms were sore and swollen from several stings. He cautiously approached the mule team and surveyed the damage. It was bad. He couldn't fix the plow himself. It would take a forge and the right tools to join the two ruined sections of steel back together, even if he knew how to do it, which he didn't. He would have to take it into town to the blacksmith to have it repaired. With no money, he had no idea how he would get it repaired. His dad was away fighting forest fires, meaning Danny and Mom were already doing more than their fair share of work while he was gone. Somehow, he would have to keep up with his regular chores and find a way to fix the plow, or he wouldn't be able to raise the nest egg money. It would set him back a full year if he couldn't plant next spring. The idea of waiting another full year to be married was more painful than the wasp stings. He didn't have time for this, but what else could he do? Chapter 4 A gust of wind blew across the road, carrying with it the sweet smell of wildflowers from a nearby field. The delicate aroma was a striking contrast to the sour smell of mash that still clung to his clothes, a parting gift from the town's distillery. Chief Howell had stopped into the distillery warehouse early this morning to pick up a gift for the new warden of Olive State Penitentiary, Butch Metz. Gift, bribe, call it what you wanted, but he knew by reputation that the man accepted bribes from all sources. Though he found it distasteful, Howell knew that a little whiskey would go a long way towards greasing the wheels and getting the crooked warden to wag his tongue. The glass bottles clinked together in his saddlebags, and Howell reached down to reposition the two bottles of moonshine there, stuffing a shirt in between them. He also carried a crate of corn whiskey strapped to the saddle behind him, an increasingly popular liquor produced by the distillery. As the gust of wind died down, the sour smell of mash reached his nose once again. His thoughts turned back to the investigation he was about to start. The suspicious death of Warden Dodson was the natural place for him to start. When something stank, you headed right for the source of the odor if you wanted to find out what it was. One crooked warden replaced with another. It was curious, that much was for certain. Howell had met the new warden a few times before and disliked him instantly. He was one of those slimy political types that were more interested in what they could get out of the system than real law enforcement. Going over the possibilities, Howell was lost in thought as his horse trotted down the road, quickly putting miles between him and Wheeler. An hour later, and another 3 miles down the road, a junction appeared on the horizon. The rural route he was on met up with two main highways. The right-hand path would lead him to Mount Olive State Penitentiary, and the left-hand path led to Huntington, where Sheriff Sutherland was from. Chief Howell squinted his eyes as he drew closer to the intersection, straining to figure out what it was he saw in the distance. A man on a horse, doing something, but he couldn't quite make any details out. As he drew closer, the hackles on the back of his neck stood up. Instinct made him pull his horse up short and lead the mare into the bushes alongside the road. Howell tethered his horse to a tree and pulled his pistol out, then ran along the backside of the hedgerow growing at the side of the road. 50 yards away now, he confirmed his suspicions. A large mass was suspended from a tree. Originally, he thought it might be a piece of deadfall from higher up in the tree, dropped by a recent storm and hung up in the lower branches. Now, though, he realized his mistake. That was no deadfall. It was a man, hanged by the neck, his feet 3 feet off of the ground, his limp body swaying back and forth in the breeze. The man on the horse had just hung another man from a tree at the fork in the road. Panting with exertion from running, Chief Howell tried to slow his breath down as he crept up on the killer. Eyes wide with shock, he forced himself to keep moving as he watched the killer reach up from his perch atop his horse and gruesomely carve the hanged man's tongue out. Blood spilled from his mouth, dripping down the front of his shirt. The killer took something from his pocket and pinned it to the man's shirt. Howell was 10 yards away now, and quietly pushed aside the undergrowth hiding him from the killer's view. Pistol leveled on the killer, he stepped out of the bushes. "Drop that knife and put your hands up. Get down from that horse, mister." The man on the horse flinched in surprise. He dropped the knife and held his hands up, fingers spread wide. "I can't rightly get off the horse without using my hands." "Figure it out. If you drop those hands, I'll blow a hole in you," Howell growled. The man hesitated and then slipped his right leg over the saddle and slid down from the horse, facing the chief. The man's horse backed away a few feet, ears flattened. The killer wore a nondescript T-shirt tucked into a pair of blue jeans, a pistol still in the holster on his belt. His dark brown eyes revealed no emotion, nor did his face. "Who are you? Why did you kill that man?" Howell asked. The killer said nothing for a moment, but simply stared at Howell, sizing him up. He then looked down at the gun Howell pointed at him, and his lips began to move.
"You're in over your head, Chief Howell. Just walk away."
"Who the hell are you? How do you know my name?" Howell demanded. "Answer my questions."
The killer laughed.
"Sutherland asked you to investigate something, didn't he? You've got no idea who you're dealing with."
Howell's eyes flicked over to the body hanging from the tree. The hanged man's face was blood-covered and too distorted to identify him. The killer made a clucking sound with his mouth, and before Howell could react, the man's horse began to walk forward, blocking Howell's line of fire. Chief Howell skirted the horse to get a clear shot, but as he rounded the horse, the killer opened fire, sending him diving for cover. As he landed on the hard pavement, pain exploded in his hip. The killer swiftly pulled himself into his saddle and spurred his horse on, then turned in the saddle, firing 2 wild shots behind him as he fled. Chief Howell, still lying on the hot asphalt, brought his gun up and carefully aimed at the killer's back. He fired off 3 shots, then watched the man fall from the saddle and collapse onto the highway, unmoving. Grunting with pain, Howell pushed himself up off of the road and rubbed his hip. He walked over to the killer, kicked the man's gun several feet away, and then rolled him over. Dead. 2 of his shots had caught the man in the center of his back, ending him. He searched through the man's pockets, finding nothing but a few bits of silver. The man's saddlebags contained little else, just a few implements for survival anybody would carry. Flint and steel, a rolled-up bundle of dry tinder, food, a container of water, and extra ammunition. The man carried nothing that Howell could use to place the man's origins or identify him. Howell walked back over to the tree where the man had been hanged. The body was still swinging as the wind pushed it around. Blood from the man's mouth covered the front of his shirt, staining and partially concealing the golden star pinned on his front shirt pocket so that Howell didn't notice it right away. A note was pinned to his shirt. It simply read, "Big Mouth." There was no mistaking the golden sheriff's star, confirming his suspicions. Sheriff Sutherland. Jerry. Howell cut the rope suspending his old friend and let him gently down to the ground. He was shocked to see him in such a condition. Less than 12 hours ago he'd talked to Jerry, and yet here he was, as dead as a doornail. Kneeling over the body, Howell removed the noose from around Jerry's neck and then ripped the killer's note off of his shirt and tossed it aside. His nostrils flared, and the cords on his neck stood up. Nobody deserved to die like this,
especially Jerry Sutherland. This murder wasn't a coincidence. Victor Tweed had sent a message. Stay out of my affairs. Whatever it cost him, he would find a way to make Tweed pay for this, and pay with